Youth Meeting, Saturday, 24th October, 1987.
We have come now to Chapter 9, The Teachers of the Upanishads. We did the first page only last time in September. We gone. Atman is transcendent awareness. Who am I? Asks the saint seer. Looking within, veil after veil of conceptions and states of consciousness disappear. Mind remains. Not your mind or my mind, but mind only, empty of all thought forms, transparent, universal, an order of life energy, which is, as it were, non-finite, self-shining space. Akasha is the word that they use. Now let's look into that. Atman is transcendent awareness. The word Atma has been translated by Western scholarship particularly as soul. And Western scholars have been conditioned to believe that a spark of the divine lives in them. That is, their immortal soul or spirit or whatever they like to call it, you see. Actually, Atman has more than one meaning. Some have derived the word from the root at, meaning to eat up. What was eaten up? The disciple or the saint or whoever it was, in deep meditation, examines his own conceptions as to what is meant by the word Atma. And the process that takes place is a process of discarding conception after conception. Sometimes because it is a misconception, and oftentimes because it leads nowhere as such. It is a limited conception. But the Atma was declared by the great Upanishadic teachers as being infinite, eternal. Now that which is infinite and eternal cannot bear a limited presentation. So all limited presentations were thrown out. And the thrown out was like expectorating that which they tried to chew. You see? That is one way of looking at the word Atma. But in profound meditation, what happens is that different states of consciousness emerge, one after the other. And each profounder state of consciousness discards all that which is temporal and finite. It is concerned with the infinite, with the eternal. The Chandogya Upanishad particularly emphasizes the aspect of the infinite where the Atma is concerned, and says that it is only the infinite which brings bliss. The infinite is said to be everywhere, north, south, east, west, the nadir, the zenith, everywhere, the totality in short, you see. So, you have to regard the Atma as infinite, but infinite what? It is a state of awareness in which you function in terms of infinity with respect to everything. Infinity and eternity, of course, go together. They are they are not really, they are not two separate things, but it is convenient to use two words like that, because infinity involves the idea of manifested things. Eternity involves states of being, states of consciousness. Time is involved in eternity. But time is, of course, only a shadow of eternity. Then old sages came to the point where they realized that timelessness is something which could be experienced and into which one could enter, provided one lived the religious life, which means essentially the life of the purification of the psyche in the full sense of the term, you see. So I put it this way, that Atma is transcendent awareness, a transcendent awareness which negates our ordinary awareness in terms of the finite and the temporal. These are all limited conceptions, and that limitation makes them into misconceptions, actually. They ask the question, who am I? The other question, of course, is, what is ultimate reality? Those were the two great questions which all those ancients asked and tried to solve. In meditation, of course, the answer to who am I was Atma, because the self is associated with consciousness of self more than with anything else regarding the self. And in answering the question, what is ultimate reality, they stated it is Brahman. Brahman is the absolute all, the all-inclusive everything, the totality, the one total reality. That's how those two words came into being. And then they went further. They declared that Atma and Brahman are an identity. Now this is of tremendous importance to us human beings, because consciousness in us is of primary importance. If one is conscious of the totality and can function easily in the context of the infinite and the eternal, then one is conscious in terms of the word Brahman. If one is conscious in terms of the self as such, which is divested of all limitations, of all misconceptions and so forth, then one talks in terms of Atma. You see, and both are identified with the primordial creative energy which brought forth the whole universe. So, Atma is transcendent awareness. Who am I, asks the sincere, looking within, veil after veil of conceptions and states of consciousness disappear. Mind remains, but mind is not to be identified with the activity of the brain as such. The brain is the apparatus, the instrument through which mind functions. I prefer to present mind as that particular type of functioning of the primordial creative energy which has a formative influence. It produces, it structures things. It brings order, it brings harmony, and so on, into existence, all existence. So, Atma, which is transcendent awareness, is empty of all thought forms. Thought forms are just verbal structures. A thought is a verbal structure, actually. It's empty, and therefore it is transparent and it is universal. You have heard me say again and again, There is no such thing as my mind or your mind or his mind or anything like that. Mind is universal and it is the one mind. It's the same with consciousness. When you are conscious in the deep sense, some great insight has emerged, then that your consciousness, what we commonly call your consciousness of that insight, is not confined to you. It affects the total consciousness of all of the whole of humanity. Of course, the extent to which humanity can respond to that is rather small, because there are so many barriers inside the human psyche which prevent that person from seeing, from benefiting from the insight of the Holy One. It's an order of life energy, prana, which is, as it were, non-finite, self-shining. This is an order of being or existence which, fecundated by transcendence, holds the archetypal forms and forces of all that is. You know Plato's great theory of the ideas, his theory of ideas, particularly truth, goodness, beauty. Those were the three things that Plato presented above all. So, they are the archetypal sources, archetypal forms of the creative energy. Of these forms, man form is the chief for us humans. They presented man form as Purusha Veda, the original man. That is to say, man as it emerged in the mind of the Creator. Of course, they conceived of the creative, of God as a creator, as a creator. And the thought in the mind of God, as the Trismegistic writings put it, is man, is the Son of God, is the Logos, the Word which creates. So it is not a word in our ordinary sense of the word, word. It is creative energy. Because God doesn't speak any human language or any other language. The language of God, if you like to put it like that, is revelation. And revelation is shapeless and formless. But insofar as revelation emerges in us, emerges in our own psyche, it takes shape because the psyche formulates it, gives it shape and substance and all the rest of it. This man form has no shape, nor size, nor continuity. For it is a birthless, deathless potentiality, unconstrained by space-time, cause-effect, or by change. You know how in Genesis chapter 1, practically the most important chapter in the Old Testament, chapter 1, and God said, this is the translation, and God said, "Let us make man in our own image." I prefer to translate it as, let us create man in our own living likeness. I think that would be much truer. That living likeness is the same as the Purusha Veda of the Upanishadic teaching. See, the Upanishadic teachings and the which are the culmination of the Rig Veda as such, probably, or possibly, I should say, were co-terminus with the Kabbalistic teachings as such. The Kabbalah came westwards with Abraham to Canaan. You see, the Rig Veda went with the Aryan speaking peoples into India. This non-finite, immeasurable, all-form, uniform form fecundates dim or colored space, rajas. Now, rajas is ordinarily translated as motion, as restlessness, activity too. A firmament or ground, and becomes the multiform, the universe as apprehended by our bodily senses and brain. My presentation of the thing is just as difficult to understand as the original writings. Now we are in the sphere of energy exchanges, the moment the multitude emerges out of the unitary. Because all manifestation, cosmic manifestation, which is material manifestation, is a case of energy exchanges. Energy becomes matter. We measure distance and time and acceleration, and we name it matter or energy mass, inanimate and animate. All separate forms in the world derive from all form. Each of us, a man form, is related to man form as primordially conceived, as put in the Trismegistic writing, the thought in the mind of God, the conception in the mind of the creative energy. Are there three orders then? Transcendence, mind only, and the natural world. No, there are not three. There is but one total reality. Each one of us is aware of only a fraction of it at any moment. The name we give to this total reality, as fragmentarily apprehended by our usual waking consciousness, is the objective world, or the natural order. Now, in this century, quantum mechanics and field theory have demolished any idea of a material world as such. All matter is pure energy. There is no objective reality to what we call matter. It's a curious thing, isn't it? It is the way our consciousness interprets that which we experience. Starting with Einstein and Max Planck, we can go on to de Broglie and Heisenberg, Schrödinger, Eddington, Jeans, and a few others like them. They have shown quite clearly that the search for the so-called objective blocks of the building blocks, the material building blocks of the universe, has ended up with discovering that there are no such things at all. They are concepts in the mind of man. But the astonishing thing is this. This is what they haven't said. I'm saying this. These concepts in the mind of man, when put to the test experimentally, worked out mathematically at first, and then devised as an experiment which can be performed, produce an impression on us, the onlookers, of materiality. We are well acquainted with the solid state, the liquid state, the gaseous state as such. We know all those three states. And we think that the solid state is absolutely solid. Yes, That is how our consciousness interprets it. But the solid state is non-existent as an objective solid. That is why in one of the chapters in my new book, having expounded all that, I end up the chapter by saying, in spite of all this, when you feel like it, shake your apple tree and material apples will fall into your basket when you shake the tree. And each of those material apples will consist of immaterial, non-existent objects. That is the real joke that modern science has perpetrated upon all knowledge. But this is curiously in harmony with what the old saint seers discovered through meditation. You see, we don't know really what meditation means. In the dictionary, meditation is said to be musing. You just think. And you go on thinking, concentrating your attention upon some particular subject in which you are interested. That is just silent talking. It is not meditating. Meditation is a creative activity. True meditation is creative action in eternity, which goes on ceaselessly. It's not everlasting in the sense, ordinary sense of the word everlasting, because that has a time feeling involved in it. Time is subsumed by eternity, just as timelessness is also subsumed by eternity. The time and timelessness are the shadowy projections upon the screen of existence of eternity. This consciousness of eternity has been realized by the founders of the religions. I don't know about Muhammad, but certainly the founders of the other great religions and all the true spiritual teachers, not the self-advertising gurus that flood various parts of the world nowadays. In subtler, quieter states, we apprehend inner depths of mind to which we are not usually awake. When such awakening reaches a peak point, we give the name mind only or pure mind, chinmatra, as it is called, in this same total reality. When all separative self-consciousness has completely dissolved and the one reality is unobstructed by the fragmentary me, we name it transcendence. When we are in fact doing what we are in fact doing, when we give these names, is to indicate our own different modes of awareness of the one and only order. There may be three modes or more or less. It is convenient, however, for the purpose of communication to talk in terms of, say, three orders. We constantly cognize multiplicity and differences. We are aware of the unity only rarely. You see, all thinking, all talking is an analytical, discriminative process. It splits up the unity. There is a famous story in the Hindu writings the disciple asks his teacher, who was a perfected holy one, a true spiritual teacher, to expound Brahman. The disciple listened and listened, and there was no sound coming from the teacher. He asked the teacher a second time, and the same thing happened. He asked the teacher a third time, and the teacher said, I am constantly demonstrating Brahman to you, but you are not yet able to understand it. The silence, if you like, is the origin. The Big Bang, as I put it in one sentence, the Big Bang broke open the eternal silence. The silence means the non-discriminative, not indiscriminative or undiscriminative, but the non-discriminative, non-analytical consciousness, which is just completely quiet. It is the source of order, universal order as such. As science has put it, chaos seems to have preceded order. The formation of the galaxies and the stars and all that sort of thing has followed the first chaos which came out with the Big Bang. But the Upanishadic teachers discussed this matter, and they disagreed with each other. Some said that primordially there was just order. The order was non-being, because being means separation. Separate beings, separate things, and so forth. And other teachers said, this comes out, the primordial order comes out in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, and one of the teachers in the Chandogya Upanishad says, no, how could the universe come out of non-being? It came out of being. He was probably a theistically minded person, and that is why he put it that way. But whichever way it is put, the reference is always to some origin which is the primordial creative source. Wait a minute. We are aware of the unity only rarely. This is due to our constitution, for even to continue to exist from day to day demands constant discrimination between all that supports life and all that destroys it. The differences make the relativity within the total reality. The one wholeness is its absoluteness. For the holy ones of the Upanishads, Brahman or Atma, realized transcendence, is that from which speech and mind return not having attained. It's a very interesting statement which comes in several Upanishads. It comes in the Taittiriya, the Shandilya, the Tejobindu, the Maitreya. I've mentioned only just a few Upanishads as reference. Transcendence, the ultimate God, if you like, is that from which speech and mind return not having attained. Because speech and mind attempt to describe. The moment you describe, you have limited. Because no description has meaning for us unless the words bear a limited meaning. Speech... Speech functions in the natural order which is characterized by finitude and particularity, by birth and death. It is the voice of the brain. That is literally true too. Speech and mind are not entirely confined to the finite, to the stream of the finite, which is the sum and substance of our usual daily life. For, without being false, speech has the strange power of contradicting finitude simply by uttering the word infinity. But whereas with all finites the brain has or produces a thought form, visual, auditory, tactile, etc., corresponding to the word, the mind is quite unable to produce any thought form, which of necessity would be finite and particular, corresponding to words such as infinity, absolute, eternity, God, and so on. See, these words negate all that happens in our ordinary everyday life, our constricted life. Our life is a limited thing. So to reach out towards the totality, the unitary whole, becomes impossible in terms of ordinary thinking. Not by thought, not by speech can that be realized, but only in that transcendent awareness, that atmic state, wherein all conceptions have dropped out. I know that several Western scholars, I think even including Monier Williams, have said that it is a state of vacuity, of vacuousness. It's nothing of the sort. It's the state of the fullness, the plenitude, and the plenitude comes out of the emptiness, the shunyata. I think we'll have to stop there today.